It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Inside Try Show with Helen Murray.
This is the podcast that takes a deeper look at the sport
with in-depth interviews and special episodes
to keep you entertained and inspired while you're training.
Perfect. And over to you.
Hello and welcome to episode 33 of the Inside Try Show, the weekly podcast with me, Helen Murray, bringing you the best interviews from triathlon and beyond. Now, apologies if I've confused you at all by putting this episode out a few days early, but I'm finally going to be taking a few days off this week and I wanted to get it all done beforehand. So, I don't know, you might have a little bit of binge listening to do. Now, this week I have a very chunky interview for you with a true gentleman, a total legend, and a proper gem of the endurance world. That is coming your way, and his name is Craig Alexander. Before then, if you haven't yet signed up to be a patron of the Inside Try Show, then what are you waiting for? Head to patreon.com/InsideTryShow. It just means that I can actually still do this every week alongside my work in cancer and exercise rehab. So I'm very, very grateful and thank you to all of the patrons who support the show. Anyway, this week's show is powered by 33fuel.com. Probably popping one of their bars in my back pocket tomorrow for my long Saturday ride. Absolute yummy, nutty joy. And it really doesn't feel like you're shoving illuminous chemicals into your body, to be honest. They do chia seed gels, they do protein powders and award-winning daily greens too. So just head over to 33fuel.com, use the code INSIDETRY33 for a discount at checkout. Guess what? Good news. We've hit 50,000 downloads, which I'm happy with that. It's just ace. So thank you for listening, for downloading, for commenting, for sharing, for reviewing. And I'd like to think that you can help me get to 100,000 downloads by the end of the year. Do you reckon that'd be a bit of a daft target? Don't know. Better to try and fail, right? So I will still need your help. So here you go. Pick an episode and send it to a friend. So any of the episodes, share it with a friend. The recent interview with Catherine Bertine is going down nicely. Stephen on Twitter said, fascinating episode this week, thank you. But so many more things to hear and learn from Catherine Bertine. Could not agree more. Definitely want to chat to her again at some point. Georgie, great episode. Can you get Chrissy Wellington on? Georgie, watch this space. Ian, wow, wow, wow. What a lady. Impressed. Loved this interview. M simply said, yay, interview with Catherine Bertine. I've been a fan of hers since I read her first two books. And Holly Leonard over on Facebook, on the Inside Try Show Facebook page, said a great listen on an early turbo session this morning. And really interesting second part on training as a female too. Lots of food for thought.
Time for this week's interview.
You know, if someone says they've never heard a bad word said about someone. Well, a very good triathlete said they have never heard a bad word said about a particular athlete. And then when someone does say that, you kind of know that you're in for a bit of a treat, right? When the opportunity to interview them comes along. Now, that particular athlete is Craig Alexander, and he's equally well known as Crowy. The Australian actually grew up dreaming of a career as a soccer player. Thankfully for us, for the triathlon world, that soccer dream kind of went out the window, but it was replaced by a dream to be the world's best triathlete. He's gone on to win the Ironman World Championship 3 times and the Ironman 70.3 World Championship 2x. In short, he's a true amazing person. Crowy, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, first of all. And a really stupid question to start off with, but I heard you talk about it the other day, so I'm going to ask, and then you can explain to everyone, where does your nickname Crowy come from?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. The nickname, yeah, it came from, in Australia we have Surf Lifesavers, and they have a competition, and it's a big nationally televised comp that they have. And in the sort of 1990s, there was a very famous surf Ironman. His name was Jonathan Crow. And I look like he does. I mean, that's the origin of it in a nutshell. I look like Jonathan Crow. His nickname was Crowy. And I mean, I was on an Australian team camp. We were having a training camp for the Australian tri team back in the mid-1990s. It was 96, 97. And we had an afternoon off training. We were watching this racing on television, the Surf Ironman. And Jonathan Crow was on. And yeah, a few of the other boys, Greg Welsh, Chris Hill, a few of the boys that were there, Greg Bennett, they said, you look like that guy. So they called me Crowy. That was 1996, early 97. And yeah, it stuck for a quarter of a century. So, you know, in Australia, you don't get to pick your nickname. I guess it's the same everywhere, I'm not sure, but in Australia, the more you protest against a nickname, the more people call you that. So I don't mind it, actually. It's kind of a cool name. He was a really good athlete, so I thought I'll go with that.
Have you ever met him?
I have met him, actually. Yeah, it was ironic because I was actually about 2 or 3 years below him at university. He was studying to be a physio and I was studying to be a physio, and I introduced myself to him one day. And also, I think it was in 2000, we used to have this nationally televised triathlon event too. It was similar to what Super League now is. We used to call it the Formula One Series or the Grand Prix Series. In fact, that's where the idea for the Super League came from. And that particular year, they partnered up with the Surf Sport Athletes. So we would do our race and then they would do their race. And we used to go out to the bars afterwards. And yeah, I had a few nights out with the real Jonathan Crow, the real Crowy, and got the endorsement from all his friends that we looked the same. So yeah, by then the nickname had well and truly stuck.
He probably thinks that you're the real Crowy.
You know, what's funny is I don't know how many years it was after that, but I ended up doing a photo book, and one of the photos is a photo of Jonathan and I, because people always ask about the nickname. And so we put a photo in the book, and he emailed me at one point asking if I could send an email to his mates because they didn't believe that I was my nickname came from him. So yeah, I think I got him a few bragging rights with his mates, because I emailed them and said, yeah, no, I'm named after Jonathan. So
that's funny. That is very, very funny. So when you were a real nipper, as you would say, were you into surf lifesaving at that point?
Not really. I grew up a little ways away from the beach. We live close now, but my main sport growing up was football or soccer. I played football for 15 years until I was 20. Played a little bit of cricket, a little bit of golf, a little bit of tennis. Like most kids, I tried all sports. Mainly team sports, a little bit of water polo. I played water polo for a few years in high school, but soccer was my football was my main love until I was 20. Ironically, my kids are into the nippers now because we live close to the beach. So they all do the nipper training, the surf sports, you know, paddling the board and swimming in the surf, and they love it.
And were you hoping to be a professional soccer player then?
I was, yeah. Well, I wanted to be a professional sports person, and it just made sense because I loved football. But for one reason or another, it didn't play out that way. Probably the main reason was I just wasn't good enough. And by the time I got to 20, my soccer career, my football career was sort of winding down. But, you know, I'd always been interested in triathlon, to be honest, because I used to, like I said, it was in the 1990s, triathlon was pretty big, particularly in Australia, because we had a couple of athletes who were winning races all around the world. So, you know, you would often see triathlons on television, particularly the race in Hawaii. You would see the Hawaiian Ironman on television. And I was always interested in it. Even when I was a football player, I used to love when October would roll around and I would watch the Ironman in Hawaii. So I did have, I guess, sort of a love for the sport of triathlon long before I ever did one.
And when did you do your first one? Were you 20 or had you done one before that?
No, I was about 20. I think it was the summer of 1993, 94. I was 20, about to turn 21. Yeah, and it was funny because I'd done probably a few months of what we used to call biathlon racing, which were just swim run races. You know, a lot of the surf clubs used to hold them, and there was actually a lot of events on that had prize money. It could be like a 500 swim, 5K run. Often they would change the order. You would run first and then swim. So I did, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 months of that sort of racing before I did a triathlon. But my best mate at university at the time was a very, very good cyclist, and he used to do triathlons for cross training. And I was always asking him about the sport, and he said, you know, you're doing these biathlon events. It's not much of a step up to, you know, to get a bike and do one more discipline. So he helped me buy a bike, and yeah, I got into triathlons. So it was around the summer of 93, 94. So just before I turned 21.
And were you hooked pretty much straight away?
You know what? I was. I from the very first race, I was. I raced in my age group in that first race. I was, at that point in time in the sport, I think juniors was 20, under 20s was juniors. Now it's under 23, but I was 21. So I was in the 20 to 24 age group. And yeah, I loved the sport from the very first race. I would say that I was bitten by the triathlon bug. I loved everything about it, the challenge of it. You know, combining three disciplines and trying to be good at all three. And just the lifestyle around it, the training, being outdoors. I was bitten by the bug hard and early. And it's still to this day, I mean, quarter of a century on, I still love everything that the sport represents. You know, when you take away, I guess, the racing or the world championships and all of that, for me, it was always just a personal challenge, you know, a way to try and push myself, be better, all the while training for three disciplines that I really liked and trying to put them together and just that lifestyle around it too of being outdoors. And but I was addicted in a good way from the very first race.
At what point did you meet Neri?
Well, Neri and I had already met. We met, it was around that time. We actually met for the first time when we were 17. We met on a beach, both on family holidays. I had just finished high school. Neri had 1 year of high school to go, and we sort of had a little summer fling. Am I allowed to say that? Fling, is that even a thing anymore? But we had a...
I think so.
We had a summer fling. And then, you know, the summer holidays ended. I lived in Sydney. She grew up on a farm just outside of a town called Tamworth, which was about 5 or 6 hours drive from Sydney. But we stayed in touch. She used to write me letters. This was back in the day where people wrote each other letters. And she would write letters and I would write letters back. And we'd have the occasional, I guess, phone conversation. And then she finished high school, and I was kind of hoping we would reconnect, but she ended up going to London to live for a year. She worked as a nanny in London for 12 months. But we stayed in touch. Again, we used to just write each other letters, and When she came back to Australia at the end of her year over there working as a nanny, she moved to Sydney to start university, and that's sort of when we reconnected. So it was around that 20 to 21. Actually, it was my 21st birthday. I invited her to my – in Australia, I'm not sure if it's the same over there, but in Australia, your 21st birthday is – it's kind of a big deal, almost bigger than your 18th birthday. Yeah. So, I invited Neri to come along and pursued her all night, chased her actually, and she tried to leave early, but I left. I left and I jumped on the bonnet of the cab. She was in a taxi trying to drive off, and I stopped the cab, it's and like I jumped in, and I left my own party to go with her.
It's like a Hollywood movie, Crowe.
Well, maybe not that romantic, but no, I disappeared. I left my own party, but no, it was probably the best decision I ever made.
I was wondering, so basically, did she go through being a triathlon widow at the very beginning? Like, were you, you know, having to find that balance between Neri and that, not addiction, but the love of triathlon, which can be all-encompassing?
Yes and no. I mean, she just grew with me as we grew into the sport. I mean, at the time I was at university, so I still had a couple of years of my physio degree, and I was also working a part-time job. And although I did get a pro license almost straight away, and I was racing in the open category or the pro category, whatever you want to call it. And I was at university 30 hours a week, and also had a part-time job, so I was training on top of that. But yeah, she was always supportive. She could see my drive, I guess. I mean, she saw firsthand the early mornings, the late evenings, fitting the training in around university and everything else. And she also saw my rapid improvement. I think everybody, when they first come to the sport, you know, when you start training seriously, you improve quite steadily, and then you almost plateau off a little bit after that. But she could see me improving, and she saw the drive and the passion I had for it, and also she knew what my dreams were, and she became a big part of the journey. I mean, you know, you hear people talk about their careers and their journeys, and, you know, often people want to talk about the world championships and everything else, but there's a lot more losing than there is winning, particularly early in your career. And, you know, there were many times early in my career, because I'd started late, you know, our friends were, I guess, starting up and establishing careers, maybe having families, and we were pursuing other things, mainly my dream. And, you know, even though I was improving, I would often say to Neri, you know, if you think I should retire, you know, I don't want this to sort of derail our relationship. I mean, that was always the most important thing to me. And she would always say, no, you know, it's, you've got a dream, you know, we're in it together. She understood. And, you know, in those early days, particularly when I was at university, you know, we would pool our money so I could go to races, I could pay to go to races, and even later on after that. So she was always a huge part of my career, and also a huge motivating factor for me when times were tough in races or in training, that, you know, it wasn't just about me, it was about us. And she'd sacrificed a lot, and so it was easy for me to push through in the harder times. But she was a huge support, and it was always just validating for me to have someone there who was so supportive, from the practical side of living, but also just emotionally. She could see when, even though I was steadily improving, that, you know, our social network, they were all doing the things that 23, 24, 25-year-olds do, and we weren't doing that. So she'd always say, no, you know, we're doing the right thing. And that was huge for me. I really needed that support. And, yeah, she provided it unconditionally all the time.
That's amazing. Crowe, in short, what was that dream?
I just had this idea that I could be a professional athlete.
Was that it, or was it winning? Was it being, you know, the best professional triathlete, or in the back of your head, were you thinking the dream is I want to win at Kona?
I loved the race in Kona because I'd watched it on television. You know, I I think if you look now compared to back then when I was growing, I mean, triathlon when I started wasn't even in the Olympics. I guess if you're a 20 or 25 year old athlete now, you've grown up. I mean, I think Tokyo next year is the sixth inclusion of triathlon in the Olympic Games. So you may have grown up with that. I grew up watching Kona on television. So, but I wouldn't say I had this dream to win it. I wanted to race there one day. I just had this idea that I could be a professional athlete and I thought I could be good at it. I mean, even as a teenager when I was playing football, you know, I would go to the athletics, the school athletics carnival or cross country, and I would win a lot of races. I would make it all the way through to regionals and even state. And it wasn't until I actually came up against the kids who actually trained for those sports that, you know, I would meet my match, I guess. But I just felt I was had an affinity for the sport. I could do well at it. It was a good fit for me. But that's one part of it. I guess the physical prerequisites are one thing. But the other thing is it just appealed to me on so many levels. I felt I can be so good at this sport because I like to train hard. I like to be challenged. I like to push myself. So I wouldn't say my dream was that I could be the world champion. I did often think about that, but I felt that I could be a really good athlete. I felt I could, you know, be one of the best in the world for sure. And I guess the commitment I made was that I just, you know, at that highest echelon of racing, you just don't know because genetics come into it. I mean, a lot of things come into it. Luck comes into it sometimes. You just don't know how it's going to play out. But I felt I was good enough to be up in that echelon. And I just made a commitment, a simple commitment to myself to really be the best athlete I could and do all the things within my power to sort of live that out.
And you said about there are so many losses before you get those wins as well. Do you remember one in particular which, I don't know, almost sort of crushed that dream?
I wouldn't say the dream was ever crushed, but I mean, you take beatings. You take beatings for sure. And they're probably worse mentally and emotionally than physically. Because as a young athlete, you're often inconsistent. You show glimpses of potential. But I think part of our sport, the physical demands of it, that strength you get as you get older, that cardiovascular fitness that builds year upon year, the consistency just comes later. Also, when you superimpose experience over the top of all of that, you understand the things you need to do to perform well each time. Sometimes as a young athlete, you have a great race and you don't really know why. What was it in the race? What decisions in the race? What was it in the lead up, the taper week or the last 3 months? So it takes a while to figure all of those things out. So I wouldn't say the dream was ever crushed, but yeah, there were times when there was just endless frustration. I wasn't replicating the training form on race day when it mattered most. Inconsistency. You know, the first two World Cup races I ever did, I was still a full-time university student and I finished eighth at Sydney and fourth in Auckland in fields of 110 hardened professionals. And, you know, on the face of it, that's good. You know, that really gives you the impetus and the motivation to keep pushing on and almost validation that, you know, I could be good at this sport. But then the next few results were in the 20s or 30s. And it's frustrating because you don't understand why you're so inconsistent. But it's just part of your development. I think, you know, in this sport, there's a physical hardening that takes place, but there's also a mental development or a mental hardening. And you almost need those tough times. You need those really soul-searching moments and that resolve because it makes you, I guess, the full package, so to speak, for later on. It just adds extra strings to your bow later on that you're going to need. And I wouldn't say that the dream was ever crushed, but yeah, there were so many disappointing moments and that's just high level sport. You win some, you lose a lot, but it's all part of the journey. You hear people say this cliche of it's not about, you know, the destination, it's about the journey. And that's so true because I think the winning that you have and the experiences that you have are a result of all those learnings along the way. you know, I would go so far as to say you probably don't get those victories without the defeats, without all those learnings. And if you do, it's probably not as worthwhile. It's very satisfying to live through something and take some learnings from that after a really tough self-evaluation. And then at some point down the track, reap the rewards of that and that satisfaction that comes with knowing that you worked for it and you were able to make some changes through mistakes and you ended up getting a good outcome. So I guess I was lucky that I was a physio student before I was a triathlete. So, you know, part of being a physiotherapist is you have an understanding of anatomy and physiology. We learn about those things. And I knew coming into triathlon that, you know, the principles of physiology, the way they are, it's just, you know, those fitness adaptations, that aerobic conditioning, just it takes years, not days or weeks or months. So I think having that knowledge in the beginning helped me deal with those frustrations later on.
Did you have like a mentor figure at all? And were there any like wise words that you remember being told, you know, when you were sort of 22, 23, is there anything that's really stuck with you?
I was very lucky. I didn't grow up. I moved to an area to train where there were a lot of great athletes and some of them took me under their wing. I was very lucky. I became good friends with McKeely Jones and her now ex-husband, Pete Coulson, who was her coach at the time. They helped me a lot. Just telling me the things I needed to do, the kind of training, the things that were important. And just watching McKeely, she was such a professional with every aspect of her training and preparation and her racing, but also the business side of things, attracting, keeping sponsors, that side of things. And also Greg Welsh. I mean, he took me under his wing at that very first training camp where he nicknamed me Crowy. You know, he at the time he was living in San Diego, but he was coming back to Australia to train and to visit. And after that initial meeting where we met at that training camp, he would always check in with me. And, you know, for a young athlete, I didn't have a coach at the time. I was self-coached. And also having not come through the sport as a junior through those teenage years where often I think you can develop not only a good grounding of the physical tools like technique and training habits, but also the confidence and the mental side of it. If you are able to perform well as a junior and have coaches telling you that you're good at this sport, just building that confidence base, you're always getting that sort of positive reinforcement that you belong and you have a chance to do something with the sport or within the sport. I didn't have that. So having people like Greg and McKeely was crucial. And I remember a few conversations with Greg. In fact, there was one track session we did together. We did it and I was still at university at the time and we finished it. And he said to me when we were cooling down, there's only a handful of triathletes in the world who could have finished that track session on those times. And two of them are right here. And I thought, he's talking about me. Is he talking about me? Because there's only two of us here. So who else is he talking about? And, you know, as a young athlete, just to get that sort of vote of approval, I guess, from a legend of the sport, a guy who'd won world titles, certainly probably one of the reasons, if not the reason I was in the sport, when he won Hawaii in 94, that was really the catalyst that got me into the sport or that made me take it seriously anyway. That was such big news in Australia when he won. So now to be doing sessions with him, let alone having him sort of mentoring me and giving me tidbits of advice and just throw away comments that, you know, as a young athlete, you're drinking up, you're absorbing every word of what this icon, this legend is saying to you. Another thing I remember he said to me in 1997, and the sport had just sort of gone from non-drafting to drafting, and it hadn't yet been in the Olympics. But in 1997, he said to me, we're on another training camp, and he said, you know, the best athletes are versatile. They can do drafting, non-drafting. They can race over different distances. And I thought, yeah, well, if that's what my hero thinks is important, that's what I want. I want to be that kind of athlete. So you know, I was still at university at the time, but I went out and did my first half Ironman 4 weeks later after he said that to me. It was the New South Wales half Ironman champs, the state championships. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny now as an older athlete, I train with a lot of younger athletes, and I remember very clearly the impact that Greg's words had on me and McKeely and a few other athletes. I got to train with Miles Stewart at different times, and I think it's very important. It's interesting your evolution through the sport. You know, I was able to have a career where now I guess I play that role to other athletes, and I'll never forget some of those conversations and just Greg checking in on me when he would come back to Australia. You know, he would call me up, and we'd often go and play golf or do something else. And actually, I was with him on the golf course. He'd retired because of his heart condition, and he had a pacemaker put in, and it went off when we were on the golf course. I think it was one of the first times it ever defibrillated him or whatever it's called. It shocked him back into a normal rhythm. And so I have a massive soft spot for Greg. He was so good to me. But yeah, I was just very lucky. These people who are legends, multiple time world champions. I mean, McKeely's an Olympic medalist, won everything. I think I read somewhere she'd won 7 or 8 medals at ITU World Championships, 2 gold. I know in the US, which is a circuit I raced on for 10 years, she'd won Chicago 7 times. She'd won St. Anthony's 7 or 8 times. She'd won in St. Croix. All the big races she'd won, not just once or twice, but nearly 10 times. So, you know, to have those sort of people, I think it's very helpful. You can't overstate how important their influence is, especially if you don't have a coach. Just getting that sort of feedback and validation is, yeah, it's very important in your development.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Was there one moment then in particular whereby you did think, almost like the confidence as well, yep, I can be the best athlete?
I can't, you know, I was so blessed throughout my career to win so many races, but I want to say that I still lacked confidence, I think, in that intrinsic confidence. I don't know. I mean, I remember a
really,
conversation
even,
I
even
had,
at the very... Even with that third world title.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember being in Kona 1 year, and there was the day before the race, and I called Pete Coulson. He was in Hawaii, and I said, you know what? And this is after I'd won, I think, 3 or 4 world titles. I can't even remember, but I was lucky to win a lot, and I don't want to play it down, but I guess the point of the story is, I called him, and I was, I guess he sensed my nervousness and my lack of confidence. And I started talking about perhaps what the race strategy should be. And he said to me, you know, I said to him, my exact words are, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow? And he said, you know what you're going to do? You're going to get on the start line and puff your chest out like someone who's won multiple world titles. That's what you're going to do. And you're going to race like someone who's got that pedigree and that sort of level of winning. So, I think confidence is one of those things. I think you can grow into yourself for sure. But I don't know if it was just the way I was naturally or because I didn't come up in the sport. Like I read about the Brownlees and Gomez and these guys who were just elite athletes as 10 or 11 year olds, you know, doing these amazing cross country races. And, you know, I think maybe if you grow up with it, you develop a confidence, that sort of understanding that you're good at this, and, or maybe it's an innate thing. I don't know, but I don't know if there was ever a moment where I just felt, in 2005, I won a big race, and I'd won a lot of big races up to that point, but that was a very big one. At the time, it was an Olympic distance race in the US. At the time, it was the highest prize purse in the history of the sport. It was an invitation only race. You had to have an incredible resume just to be there. And then it had a unique format too. They used to race, the guys and the girls would race each other. So they would give...
Was that Hy-Vee?
They would give the good... It was before Hy-Vee. So Hy-Vee was a big money race, but this was before that. There was a race called Lifetime Fitness.
Yep.
And Hy-Vee used to run, the guys and the girls would race. Lifetime Fitness was a little different because what they would do is they would give the girls a head start based on... They had some... I don't know, equation that they use looking at all Olympic distance races for 12 months, and they'd give the girls a predetermined head start, and the boys would stand on the beach and wait as the clock would count down. And so you had to race the boys, but you also had to try and catch the girls. And, you know, in 05, I won the race. I was lucky enough to beat the boys and catch the girls. And I was the first boy to actually win. I think Barb Lindquist had won it a couple of times, and then Loretta Harrop won it. And then I won it. And to win, I had to beat Simon Whitfield, finished second. He was the 2000 Olympic champion, and Hamish Carter was up there. I want to say he was on the podium or in the top five. He was the Olympic champion from the previous year in Athens. And on the ladies' side, the last girl I caught at about 7K into the race was Emma Snosel, who was a three-time ITU world champion and obviously went on to win the Olympics. Even after winning that race, I remember sitting there in the drug testing afterwards, just, yeah, it's kind of hard to believe that I'd done it. So I don't know if there was ever a point where the penny dropped and I thought, I mean, and I'd won big races up to that point. The year before, I'd won Chicago and LA, won a couple of ITU races in the US, and I'd won St. Croix, which was a big race on the US scene, three or four times by then. A few Australian titles as well. So I don't know. I mean, I guess it's what we talked about at the start. It's just part of that mental conditioning and mental development you have throughout your sport. And, you know, even through all the winning and losing, whichever it happened to be on the day, and it's not lost on me how lucky I was to win so often. For me, it was always just about the next race. You know, I would try and take whatever lessons there were and just move on. It was the only thing that mattered was the next result. You couldn't rest on your laurels from a big win. You would try and enjoy them and celebrate them, but, you know, if you won a race, I would do that sort of agonizing self-analysis. If I lost a race, I would do the same thing and just move on. The next race for me was always the most important thing and the only thing really that mattered.
Do you think that is why it's so difficult to retire? Not for you, but generally as a sports person.
It's a great question. I think it plays a lot into it for sure. I mean, it's hard to find something that, for me personally, I can only speak for myself, that stimulates me and drives me the way triathlon used to, and trying to up my performance each time and be better than that version of myself that was on the start line at the championships the previous year. That was almost like a drug for me. It was just that drive and that desire and that motivation. I loved it. I loved the whole process of planning the year, gearing up for one or two races. I loved the pressure that was around it. It was all about the performance, not just the winning. It was about the performance. That was the most important thing. And, you know, I even remember being in the medical tent after the race in Kona. I think it was in 2008. I just won the first time, and it was a relief, I guess, and it was very emotional. But I also was already thinking about the next year, and Neri was standing next to me. I was in the medical. I was getting a drip. I was getting an IV, and Neri was on the phone, and she was talking to someone back home in Australia, either her parents or my parents. And I was like, I need to borrow your phone. I need to borrow your phone. And she's like, what? And I said, I want to make some notes about the race. And she couldn't believe it. She was like, can you just stop for 1 minute and enjoy it? And, but that was, I was enjoying it. Part of the enjoyment was I felt I'd uncovered a couple of really important things that would help me next year even more. That was part of the enjoyment for me. It was just an ongoing process of, it didn't just stop for that moment in time. But I did enjoy it. I mean, I enjoyed the aftermath, you know, basking in the glory, I guess, the after party a day later. It's amazing. And coming back to Australia and all the things, I guess, that go with winning those sorts of races. But for me, again, it was just about next year already. It was, I was already thinking, how can I up my game? And you know, that race, that experience, that day, I'd learnt a lot of valuable lessons that I thought I wanted to, while they were fresh in my mind, I wanted to document them so I could use them moving forward in the planning, the training, nutrition, all those sorts of things, just little nuggets of gold that I really wanted to crystallize while they were fresh in my mind. But yeah, Neri was just completely over it. She wanted a holiday and she didn't hand the phone over. She stormed off. So
that's what you want, a tiff after becoming world champion. Do you still struggle? You were mentioning about that doubt in your head, even now when you get onto a start line, is there a bit of a lack of confidence or?
Yes and no. I mean, you would hope that as you get older, you know, there's not too many things I've enjoyed about getting older, growing old. But one of the things is I think you mellow out a little bit. You develop a different insight into things. You become more, particularly, you know, becoming a dad, I loved. And it just, I think you get a better perspective about life as well. You know, I'd like to think I know more, or I'm a better person now than I was maybe 5 or 10 years ago, just because I've learnt more and I've experienced more. So I don't know. I think you are who you are for better or worse. And I think part of the journey, and this is what I say to young athletes, is there's no right or wrong. You have to be self-aware, understand who you are, and you know, and go with that. Understand what makes you good, maybe the things that can undermine you as well. And I think knowledge is power. If you know those things, you can maybe put in place strategies that help you optimize the good things and minimize the bad things. So, you know, the confidence thing is an interesting one. I think about it often. I think, you know, the only time I can really say in my career that going into a race, particularly the race in Kona, that I really felt super comfortable was 2011. I just felt that was a culmination of a physical and a mental progression that was meeting. It was kind of like a perfect storm, I guess. I just really felt my mental development had caught up to my physical development, and I felt that I was a formidable athlete. So I guess there's a level of confidence there. There was a level of understanding that I've progressed to the point that I'm really comfortable at, and I'm really looking forward to this race on the weekend. I remember that whole week in 2011 just being much more relaxed than in the past. So who knows why that is? I mean, that could have just been a personal or emotional thing as well, having the kids there. But I think an element of it was the performance, for sure, and the mental development, just the performances, the physical performances I'd seen in training in that year, but also the mental development. I felt I had a confidence that I really hadn't displayed at any other race.
It's amazing. And at that finish line, would you have compared notes with Chrissy Wellington that year?
Chrissy and I were really good friends. We used to compare notes in Colorado, in Boulder. not only training, but more just life notes, I guess, and dealing with the things outside of the sport. And the interesting, you know, I guess it's a funny story. Every year I won in Kona, Chrissy had won. So I always had to give my winner's speech after she'd given her speech. And I want to tell you, knowing that is more daunting and more pressure than getting on the start line with the best athletes in the world, because she is such a thoughtful, innovator, just a great lady. I just enjoyed her company. I loved watching her race. But yeah, you know, after the race, you've won, you're happy. There's, you know, it's funny when you build up to a major race, there's always, it's always in the back of your mind. Even you could be months out, but you know, there's a day of reckoning, it's coming. And then when you finally get to that race and get through it and have a great outcome, and you know, you've got to give your speech after Chrissy, that it's in the back of your mind for the next 2 days until the awards party. So, her speeches were incredible, very long, but awesome. And, but we were good friends. I think we were good friends. I mean, you know, you go through a career and I think you form relationships with people who you like and who you respect, and maybe who go through the same things that you go through. There's an understanding there. So yeah, I always loved Chrissy. She was great to see in Colorado, training at the pool, and always awesome to watch race. So yeah, she was one of my favorites.
I was just thinking the difference between those journeys to that 2011 race would have been quite something. If you're going in with confidence, and she would have been going in with so much doubt.
Yeah, she had such a crazy build up that year with the bike crash, but it goes again. I mean, you talk about confidence, and you know, the great athletes are able to win when maybe they're not at their best physically, and that's when you see how much the mindset and mentality plays into sport. The great athletes in any sport, I think, over long periods of time, the ones who are consistent, I think it speaks more to their mentality and their mindset and even their physical ability. And she was huge that year. She was a giant, mentally, just to go through that, such an uncertain build-up, and, you know, still be able to deliver that performance.
Amazing. Now, Crowe, you are soon to be, when this goes out, you may be 48. You're about to turn 48. What is the secret?
47.
Oh,
47.
God, I'm so, yes, sorry. I did.
No, that's good. Taken.
No, it's
no,
all right.
Offense taken.
It's funny because I can't do maths, but I really can't do maths. That's hilarious because I was born in 83. You're born in 73. I know I'm 37. I haven't turned 38.
That's an easy one. That's an easy one for you.
How did I get that so wrong? Okay, you're about to be 47. Yeah, what is the secret to still being racing at this point? So the longevity.
Passion, loving it. Yeah, and look, I think you need to understand, too, I haven't raced in Kona for 7 years now. I think you need to, or 6 or 7 years, you need to find a place mentally that you're comfortable with. And for me, it's not about racing major championships. It's just being involved, only race. I think I raced 5 times last year. The year before that, it was maybe only 2 or 3 times. I like to train every day. It's part of my routine. Physically, I really enjoy it. Mentally, I think I need it. It helps me. Also, my eldest daughter, is a great runner. So she has a running scholarship to a really good high school. So I need to train to be able to keep up with her and her running group. I
mean, you do sessions with her, don't you?
I do. And I love that I'm able to train with her. That's probably the main reason that I'm still training. The fact that she asked me to go running with her, I just love that. So, but as for the racing, I mean, it's when I do race, for me, performance is still important. It's still about performing at a level that I know I can perform at. I know what that level is, and it's still a very high level. The difference now is, though, that my schedule is not based around racing and training. So I have to be realistic, and I keep the training ticking along in the fitness sort of at a decent level. And when it becomes evident that there's a gap in the schedule with no traveling and the family commitments are maybe not as great as they were, I can select races. So I tend to pick races a lot later, which is different to how I used to do it. I'd schedule the whole 12 months in advance. And then when I get in that window of opportunity, I ramp the training up a little bit because, yeah, performance is important for me. I don't just want to make up the numbers. I want to perform at a high level. Part of the enjoyment for me is the performance. And also, I guess at this age, what's different now, I guess, from 10 or 20 years ago is the technology around the equipment, what we know about training and recovery, all those things. I think, you know, just if we just use bikes as an example, the aerodynamics around bike design, what we know about proper bike fit, you know, ceramic bearings, proper wheel aerodynamics, tires, rolling resistance, all those things. You know, I certainly physically am not at the level I was even two or three years ago, but I think I'm still putting out decent times that are comparable because of these other advances that are, you know, I'm seeing that the power numbers are not what they used to be, but the times on different race courses that I go back to are quite similar. So, yeah, it keeps me interested. I like to keep up with the evolutions in the sport and the technology, and it's part of all sports, I think, now. And the softwares, the wearable technologies, all of those things. It's interesting to me, but yeah, I think you talk about longevity. It comes down to passion. You've got to love what you do. It's got to have a deeper meaning and a drive for you, not just about winning or performance. And you've got to look after your body. You know, I've been lucky. I think I was blessed with good biomechanics. But it comes back to that physio degree and that education and knowledge. I understood the things that were important in terms of efficiency of movement and proper functional movement to stay injury free, but also to perform at a high level. So, you know, I've always incorporated that thinking even now into just staying healthy.
There's just a couple more things I want to ask. One of them is I get a bit of a kick if I pass a guy on a bike. So like that slight kick. Do you get, if you're in a race, do you get that? Yes, when you whiz past someone in their 20s.
Yes and no. I've got to say, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, it's kind of nice to race. I mean, I was at a race a couple of years ago and I can't remember I think it was Mauricio Mendez who was the Xterra World Champ a few years ago. And we're at the press conference and he said that I was racing as a professional athlete before he was born. And that makes me feel good to think that I'm still at that level and racing, you know, able to race as a pro athlete. I think, yeah, it's nice. I'm not going to lie. I wouldn't say I'm super motivated to, you know, kick all these young guys' butts, but it's certainly nice to be in the race and look around and see these, you know, really young, strong, talented athletes and think, wow, man, it's cool. I'm still in the mix here. And they keep me honest. I know when I'm going into these races, you know, the guys in their 20s, but also the guys in their 30s who are more established now and who are world class. You know, if I enter a race and I know some of those guys are in the race, I've got to prepare. It just keeps you accountable in your training as well, because you know you're going to get tested by world class athletes. And that's what it was always about for me. It's just that challenge, the unknown and trying to get the best out of yourself. But no, I'm not going to lie. It's nice to look around, especially in transition. You look at all these young, fit bodies and think, man, I used to look like that. A couple of decades ago, I did look like that. Those ripped muscles.
And then in terms of brand and sponsorship, obviously, as you get older as well, like, I think it's incredible that there are so many brands out there that still, you know, love what you do, kind of love you as a person, want to be working with you. Has it surprised you that there are still those opportunities, even though you're nearer 50 than you are 40?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting growing up as an athlete as a professional athlete. Your mindset, your mind gets wired a certain way that your value is in winning. I mean, I did races where I finished second and had great races, but all the media attention, all the focus went on the winner. And I think that does something to your mentality. You understand that that's where it's at. So it certainly, I think it does something to your mindset. You strive for that. And that is good and bad. I think it sets the bar high and it motivates you and drives you, but it can also lead you into that, I guess, pitfall of thinking that your only value is tied up in your results. So to answer your question, it does surprise me what did in the beginning, because for the longest time I thought the only value I have is that I'm winning. That's the only value I have. And when I stop winning, I'm going to have no value. And that's kind of it's a bad mindset to have. It's a bad, I think it's a bad thought process to have, but that's, you see it in sport. It's the old saying, to the winner goes the spoils. I mean, you see it time and again, that the great sponsorship opportunities, the media, the glory, the magazine covers. And I think that just, it does something to your mindset around your development, and perhaps it helps you, it toughens you up and helps you win. But coming out the other end of it, I think, yeah, it was interesting for me that a lot of my sponsors who I had for a long time, decades or more, I guess saw the value in keeping me around. And that's a nice feeling to know that what you did, because a lot of people win races and you have your stars from a generation or an era, and then the next generation comes along and there's great new stars who are incredible and awesome. And but the fact that companies see the value in, keeping you around and that maybe their values as a company align with what you stand for over a long period of time, that's really nice. I'm not going to lie. It's a nice feeling. It's rewarding to think that maybe you stand for a little more than just performance. Perhaps the way you conducted yourself was important to your partners, and it's what they feel that they represent. And also another side of it is the promotional side, is you understand that you can leverage your relationship different ways. When you're winning, I guess you're on television, you're visible. There's a high level of engagement, I guess, high exposure. But there's other ways to leverage partnerships as well. Engaging with the audience, going to trade shows, expos, retailers, doing a lot of more media work. I guess it's the business side of sport that you come to learn and understand over time. The athlete's mentality is a good one. I wouldn't swap the life I've had. I've loved it. But it certainly hardens you mentally. And I'd like to think I'm a bit softer now coming out the other side. And you also learn and become more philosophical about things. But I'm humbled to think that companies still feel that. I mean, because in the end, I'm not naive to think that we're still not talking about moving the needle. It's about selling things. But I guess I'm in a fortunate position where I've always used the product, and I had a choice of what I wanted to use. And for me, it was about going faster. Bottom line, it was about going faster, performing better, getting the most out of myself. So I always made my decisions on sponsorship around that. And I understand not everyone's in the same boat there. I was very lucky, and that's not lost on me. So, but you know, I am always surprised that companies want to keep an old boy around. So, but very grateful.
And obviously you have been around a long time. You will have raced many, many people. If there was one person that you haven't raced that you would like to have raced, male or female, who would that be?
I've raced a lot. I mean, there's so many great athletes. I've never raced Javier, and that's probably lucky for me. He's incredible. I did race Alistair in a 70.3. Was it last year? I think it was last year or the year before. He won. I finished second. He's incredible. There's just so many. I mean, I love all the great champions. Loved McKeely. I thought she was incredible. Emma Snowsall was incredible. I really think Jan's amazing. Just so professional, so classy, just so good in all of this. All those, all the names I mentioned, they're all. I think the champions these days are a lot more polished, maybe because they came up through the sport at a younger age and they had really great coaching. I look at Javier and Jan, their techniques are amazing. I guess someone from my generation who was like that was Hamish Carter. He had beautiful swimming technique, incredible running technique. Yeah, so many to name. I don't know. I mean, I liked the way Loretta Harrit raced, mentally very tough. Of course, Chrissy's a favorite. I love Marinda Carfrae as well. It's hard to pick because they're all different, but they're the same as well. They have that great tenacity, that toughness, that class, that incredible ability to race consistently, which I think is an important quality, but always elevate when it matters the most. So many great athletes. I came from a great era. I mean, I loved Bevan Doherty, was very tough. Simon Whitfield, so classy. Probably the prettiest runner I've ever seen. Craig Walton. I think he's perhaps the best Olympic distance non-drafting triathlete I ever raced against or saw. Greg Bennett, incredibly consistent. Simon Lessing, I think, was the original prototype. Like now we look at Alistair and Javier as those guys who have no weakness. I think Simon was the first. So many. Karen Smyers, I loved her versatility. She won ITU Worlds and Hawaii in the same year, which is, granted, in the 90s, the athletes did all the distances. Now, I think the level in each discipline is so high, you have to specialize. But the fact she was able to do that, I think, is incredible. It's hard. I'm a fence sitter, as you can tell.
It's a rubbish question. Don't worry about it.
It's a tough. I mean, you're just set up to fail. It's too hard to answer that question. There's so many, but they're all great for different reasons and for the same reasons, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes absolute total sense. Quick answer: are you going to be racing? Well, COVID, who knows? Are you planning to do more races in your Aussie summer?
I would love to, yes. Yeah. That was the plan. I was building up. I had a pretty decent schedule of racing through March, April, May. I've been doing more surfing than swimming lately because our pools are closed. So, although I feel the high elbow action is helping.
Relevant. It's all relevant.
It is relevant. Specificity of training. I haven't done this much surfing for 20 years. But yeah, that's my plan. I mean, hopefully the racing will, obviously the restrictions are different all around the world. And I mean, who knows? I think we're all just sort of on the edge of our seats, hoping that for the best case scenario that we can all get back to the things that we love. But yeah, I would love to race again.
So no plans to sort of fully retire quite yet?
Well, I'm always going to train for life,
yeah,
for general
crack
health
on
and well-being, and I'm always going to crack on, just train. And you know, I guess when you've got 25 years of aerobic conditioning, it's not a big difference between that and just bumping it up a level or two for a race. So we'll see. I mean, yeah, let's see what happens in the spring or summer down here.
Crack on, I say. Right, I'm going to let you crack on indeed and go and get some more beers in you because it's beer time. It's Friday evening.
It's Friday evening. Happy hour.
Oh, it's a happy hour indeed, and Barbies and everything. So, Crowe, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to the team at TRR Nutrition for helping me to set up the interview with Craig. TRR Nutrition is an industry-leading sports supplement brand that develops products for elite-level endurance athletes. And their products are things like the TRR Pro Advanced Collagen Liquid Supplement, and they've got a range of protein supplements as well. And here you go. I reckon if it's good enough for Tim Don, for Crowe, for Andy Murray, then it's good enough for you too. And even better, you can get 15% off all purchases at trrnutrition.com until the 30th of September 2020 using the code INSIDETRY15.
Thanks for listening to the Inside Try Show. If you want to get in touch or get a little bit more information on anything, then reach out to Helen on Instagram or Twitter at Inside Try Show.
So do let me know what you thought of that interview with Crowe. As you can probably tell, once again, it was such a lovely way to spend an hour on a Friday morning chatting to a very passionate person and, yeah, someone who was very engaged and very generous with their time as well. I, quite frankly, I blooming loved it. And I think I said the other week that a few hours after interviewing Crowe, then I was able to do the Tim Don interview as well. So, yeah, it was a very good Friday morning. Anyway, some other wins this week. Well, this morning, I went for an early morning spin. I didn't do 6:45 yoga club. It was more like 7:45 when I got back. But, yeah, I watched the sun climb over the Peak District. It was very nice. Lay down halfway for a moment, listened to the birds, rode home again. It was great. We did do some big hills in the Peak District last Saturday. We went cycling, Rich and I, with a friend, which was really, really nice. I had an urban open water swim this week on the hottest day of the year so far. So we were in the water at 7 o'clock in the morning and it was just glorious. And it's in a place called Salford Quays, which is on the outskirts of Manchester. And it used to be for me right on the doorstep of work. So sometimes on a Wednesday evening, I would quite honestly walk out of the office in my wetsuit, not even joking, when I used to work at BBC Sport. But I think I took it for granted, actually, because it's genuinely a really nice place to swim. So it was good to be back on a sunny morning doing that this week. And then yesterday evening, once again, I did yoga over Zoom with my brother in Australia. It's one of the biggest wins of lockdown. It's just great to be able to do something with him, even though we are miles and miles and miles apart. But as someone said, it's mad that I can do that. So join Manu Mission Yoga in Sydney over Zoom. Yeah, I still can't go to Wales. It's crazy. Anyway, I think the biggest win is coming up, and that is that I'm having a few days off. I feel like it's been a little bit non-stop since March, really. Maybe even Christmas, I don't know. So, yeah, a lot of things have been cancelled. I had various trips lined up. I was meant to be going on coaching on a women's cycling camp in Lanzarote. That was meant to be happening. I was meant to be going to Roth as a race host with Sports Tours International. Obviously, that's not happening. But those kind of things, and races as well. I was meant to be doing another long distance triathlon on the 21st of June. So yeah, all of those things have gone. And I guess during the main bit of lockdown, life felt pretty intense, didn't it? But it also felt, well, what's the point in taking leave because I can't really go anywhere. But now that things are easing a little bit, and actually it's a bit like training, isn't it? You can't go on and on and on. You do need rest days as well. So yeah, my brain's feeling pretty fried. But now that things are easing a bit, there is a lot of point in taking some leave. So we are going to do that for a few days. But please do carry on with the messages, the shares. Go and give Inside Trishow a like on Facebook too if you haven't done so already. And if you're listening now and you're thinking, that was a great interview with Craig Alexander, I want more of that, or, you know what, I really like what Helen does, and if you wouldn't mind buying me a coffee every month or a glass of wine, then what's stopping you? Head over to patreon.com/InsideTryShow. This week's show has been powered by 33fuel.com. You can get your hands on 6 protein bars, their premium protein and their ultimate daily greens as part of their special lockdown bundle. Use the code InsideTry33 for a discount at checkout. Now, it is a Friday evening while I'm recording this again. Wine is awaiting downstairs, clearly. So, have a good week. I'm off downstairs. Look after yourself, look after those around you, and we will speak again next week.
Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.